Okay. Oh my God, you guys, it's 2021.
Yes, finally.
Can you believe that? I think we all agree we're not gonna do the typical like last year 2020 recap because it was a shit show and we all know that. But yep. Happy New Year. Welcome
to Happy New Year!
Quarantine Casualty Friday. We are your hosts. This is
I'm Felicia Rose.
I'm Tiffany Shepis.
And I'm Kane Hodder.
Today, I think we're going to talk about, you know, the new year, the little bit of the end of the last, new beginnings. Some might call it the new batch, which is a little hint to our first of the year guest. If anybody out there listens and you can get that right and you tweet it in, Felicia will give you a prize.
I have Angela Sticka.
Yes, perfect. It's what everybody wants for the new year. But we are excited to have a fellow Hatchet alumni. I mean, that could be anybody. There's a lot of people in the Hatchet franchise, right? Kane, can you name all of them?
Okay. You ready?
But who's your favorite kill?
He already said it wasn't you.
I know.
I just keep trying. I'm a glutton for punishment. I love your office, Kane. I like your background. You look amazing.
Yes, Kane has a new office. But
brand new. Today is my first day using it. Whoa. Literally.
This is like the de-virginizing of your office?
De-virginizing?
What would it be? De-virginizing.
We are
breaking the hymen of that office.
Breaking the hymen on my office.
Just right through the wall.
Oh, it looked like my kill the way you did that.
Now, you made me just think of something to ask you two about broken hymens.
So. Oh, my God. Well, I think we should wait for our office co-worker to answer these kind of questions because we not only have a Hatchet alumni, he also happens to be the guy to destroy Sweet Gizmo's life in Gremlins. And he played everybody's like favorite awful rich kid in Waxworks. And we have the awesome Zach Galligan. What? And joining us for Casualty Friday, Zach Galligan with no audio or picture, but it's coming. Zach's Yay! Decided to leave. Zach!
There it is.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, Kane.
Hey.
Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. How are you guys doing?
We are good. We were discussing Kane Hodder's new office that he's in. It's very exciting.
Riveting conversation here at Casualty Friday, Zach.
Like, you know, I've never had an office in a home because I'm not like you rich people that have a big enough home to dedicate one room to be an office. So I've never had it. So I leased this space up in Park City and I'll be using this for the next year.
Yeah, Park Zach, City, don't. Utah?
What?
Park City, Utah?
Yes. We built a house up here about a year and a half ago and I think we're gonna get rid of Calabasas.
Sounds like a good plan. Yeah.
Rich people problems.
Wait, I just want to say one thing. Zach, you look so handsome and dapper.
Oh, thank you.
I just want to, you know, bring attention to that. You look very lovely. And we want to know all about you, how you're doing and what's going on in your life.
Yeah. I can't really see what I look like, so I'm just going on.
it's apparent. It's really, Felicia doesn't often give those kind of compliments. So
I'm a tough.
She's the tough crowd on Casualty Friday. So I am certain you are an avid listener of Casualty Friday, Zach, and you are just such a huge fan that you know how our show works, where we sort of kind of interview you, but we also sort of just talk about topics that are interesting to us, which is usually dumb things, like Kane's new office and the rich people problems of Kane Hodder not making enough money being Jason to ever have said office.
Yeah.
So
Never.
That's sort of how this goes. But we're really happy you're here because we actually talked about you on the last Casualty Friday when we were talking about Gremlins being a Christmas movie. And I don't know, what do you think about that? I mean, you're clearly Mr. Gremlins.
Well, I get asked the question, obviously, a lot, especially this time of year or up until around Christmas. And basically what I say is, it doesn't really matter what I think. It kind of matters what the audience has decided. And the audience has decided that it's a Christmas movie. Now, originally when it came out in June of 1984 and it was a summer movie, but that was 36, almost going on 37 years ago. It's as much as it pains me to say that. And, you know, over the years, people have forgotten pretty much, most people have forgotten about the fact that it came out in the summer, if they ever even knew that. So
I didn't know that.
It was a Christmas theme and it's a Christmas movie and people have adopted it as such and it shows constantly at Christmas. And so it's a Christmas movie now.
Why on earth? Was there a re-release? Did it come out then in December of 84 as well? How did they do the release?
They did re-releases. I think, I don't remember exactly when, but they did a re-release, I believe it was the following summer, where they were kind of like, hey, we're back, you know, kind of thing like that.
Guess what? We're here again.
They did a Christmas release last year. And I'm sorry, by last year, I mean 2019. So 13 months ago, they did in December 2019, they did a Christmas release. And amazingly, this summer, they did a drive-in theater release during COVID, and it was in like the top six movies for the week that week. So that's it was in cool. the top 10 again this summer.
Did you get to go?
I've seen it, so I kind of
decided watch to movies wow.
during a pandemic and just look at the box office results and be happy that it was in the top 10 again.
There you go.
Yeah, let's be honest, it's one of the biggest movies ever. Really? I mean, it's quite spectacular.
Well, we talked about that on our last show, was that it was a film that really just kind of transcended all ages and genres. Like we watched it with our 16-year-old daughter and her friend and our 7-year-old. And, you know, even the 7-year-old still was like, this is not nice. Like the lady's mean to the dog. And like, you know, he was very upset by the fact that you, Zach, this is totally your fault. Let Gizmo just have a bad night. Or maybe it was Feldman's fault. Probably Feldman. But
aww.
It was, he was very upset with you.
What I always tell people is that, you know, if 2 hours goes by and I haven't broken any of the rules, it's not going to be much of a movie. So you kind of need me to break the rules and Corey, so I'm not a complete doofus. And the Gremlins also... it's clever the way that it's plotted. If you stop and think about it, the gremlins chew the alarm clock. So again, that's not my fault because ostensibly I'm obeying the rules. It's just, I've been tricked into not being able to do it correctly. So Billy really only, you know, he's not really a complete clod and breaks all of the rules. He is trying. He's just, you know, he's being thwarted at every turn, whether it's by an 11-year-old Corey Feldman or a group of mogwais chewing electrical cables.
All right, fair enough. It was not Billy's fault. I'm going to tell that 7-year-old, like, listen up, kid. He did everything he could. But so you have something in common with all of us, and since clearly you listen and watch Casualty Friday all the time, you would know this, but all of us were in the same Hatchet franchise. And Kane, did you kill Zach? Do you remember making it? Did you have a good experience making the Hatchet series?
Yes, let Zach tell it.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that the Hatchet experience, as you call it, was really two separate experiences for me. One was, and the vast majority of it was this, was shooting down in New Orleans and staying at the Ponchar Train Hotel with Kane right across, literally across the hall in the room.
Oh no.
And I really didn't see much of Kane during the Hatchet 3 filming because he would, I mean, he can talk about this more clearly, but he would like to basically go off and do his thing and get into the role and sit by himself and just do whatever preparation that he felt was necessary. So there wasn't a whole lot of mingling with Kane on the set or even off the set.
Or even on the show. We stay far away from Kane. I don't know what happened to Felissa. She just left us somehow.
Well, she's got stuff to do. She'll be back.
She'll be back.
And so there was the New Orleans sequence. And then there was a very large sequence that was actually shot on a set in Adam's backyard. He has an office located in the depths of the valley, and it has a rather large backyard in it. And he built the set for the ambulance boat in the backyard. So what happens is my character, I don't want to necessarily spoil it, but my character gets into a precarious situation where he sticks his head through a hole and may or may not have horrible things happen to him. And so at that juncture, when we shot that, it was months afterwards. And, you know, it was crazy because it was basically Perry.
We love Perry.
And Riley and myself trapped in the ambulance boat. And so the three of us essentially did that whole, my possible death, possibly survival, if you haven't seen the movie, but the climactic sequence was shot, you know, several months later in Los Angeles, as opposed to the sequence that was shot in New Orleans in June of 2012, I believe, in the heat of the summer in the bayou. And Kane can tell you how great that was in that suit.
It was just, you know, I've worked in...
Oh, he loved it. What are you talking about, Kane?
I worked in New Orleans before, and it was bad enough not having the makeup on a movie, but having that makeup on, it was so incredibly uncomfortable, which I've talked about before, but, you know, Zach, I was going to ask you about, you know, the fact that we did that scene on the ambulance boat so much later, is from an acting standpoint with dialogue and stuff, is that a little tricky or not necessarily to remember, you know, because you may do a shot that is edited right from a previous shot that you did in New Orleans months before. Is it tricky to have the constant, whatever frame of mind you were in? Because for me, I'm just fucking crazy and violent all the time. So it doesn't matter. I don't have to have any continuation of something or some, you know, but I wondered if that was a little tricky or if you're just not really concerned with it.
Well, I mean, certainly one of the things that happened with my performance in Hatchet 3 was I originally decided when I took the part, I was going to do it with a Cajun accent. And I went down to New Orleans, and to my horror, I discovered very few people actually spoke with a Cajun accent. None of the police people that I met spoke with a Cajun accent. So I was like, this is just not going to work. I mean, it's not, you know, unless I'm trying to do Dennis Quaid in The Big Easy.
Oh, that's great.
You know, it's not going to work. It's going to look ridiculous and inauthentic, and people in New Orleans are going to be like, what is he doing? We don't talk like that. I didn't really know what to do. And then I got introduced to Caroline Williams, played my wife. And, you know, she's from Houston, Texas. And she's got in real life, she has a reasonably thick Houston accent, or at least it comes out at times when she wants it to. And so I started talking to her. And next thing I know, I started sort of mimicking her a little bit like this. And then I thought, you know what? Maybe I'll just do like a George W. Bush kind of Houston style accent for the entire thing. So I liked that, and it worked because it made me feel like, oh, Caroline and I met in Houston, and then I transferred to New Orleans, which apparently happens all the time. because Houston and New Orleans are fairly close to each other. So that gave me the idea to do it with kind of a Texas accent. And then once I had the Texas accent, I decided I was going to make it really kind of over the top, because it is, after all, a swamp monster movie, you know?
Exactly.
And it was kind of like, it was going to be sort of an homage and a slight tribute to some of the, you know, really fun over actors from the 50s and 60s and 70s, 80s horror movies.
Oh, you so mean all was, of us?
I know. Like,
Could you be talking about Tiffany and Felissa? Thank you.
You know,
so basically, to answer Kane's question, the challenge was, you know, kind of to remember where I was and how the accents sounded and flowed. And I think, I can't really remember, because we're talking about 8 years ago. I think I had either Will Barrett or Adam Green play me back some footage so I could hear my accent again. I have a pretty decent ear. So once I hear it again, I could kind of go, oh, right. Yeah, it was that, you know. And then I started running the lines a few times, and then it came back. But I did think to myself, and I've thought about this a lot, you know, when you look at performances like Breaking Bad, where these characters all have, you know, 7-8 months off in between seasons, and yet they come back, and it's so consistent. It's really a lot harder than it looks. And that's, I was really fascinated when I saw Anthony Hopkins come out and say that he thought that, why am I blanking on the lead guy's name in Breaking Bad? You could be kidding me. Bryan Cranston. He said that Bryan Cranston's performance is one of the greatest achievements in acting, because not only is he so incredible in it, but he did it with like 4 or 5 interruptions of months at a time, and still managed to come back and find the sort of the central focus and essence of the character. And it's true. And I have a lot of respect for actors that do television and have big breaks and then have to come back and like, oh yeah, this character again. It's
and especially for that series too. Like he went from being, you know, like you're sad for him. It's just this Family Guy to like this batshit crazy, like everything in that. There's so many layers to that, and to be able to play it and it not seem fake in any of the levels is incredibly hard. Like he's great.
Well, we did it too with Victor Crowley. I mean, we shot in September, and then I shot most of my stuff. We did the plane and then all the bookstore and outside.
Oh, yeah.
In the beginning. And not the anything, Zach, but I had to carry this kind of an accent. So I, too, know what you're talking about.
She understands acting.
I get acting. When you bring on those accents, they got to be perfect. Okay.
Well, and who knows better than me? When I was slaughtering motherfuckers in New Orleans, I did it with a Cajun accent.
Of course you did.
Just for my performance only. Nobody would really pick up on it, but it was just for my own use.
We did. We saw it. We knew.
I have murdered people violently in many different languages and dialects. And
right. How many people have you killed in the whole Hatchet franchise?
Oh, actually, I believe somebody counted. Wait, I think it's in my phone, actually.
Really?
Oh, don't pretend like you don't know. He's like 148.
213 and a half.
Let's see here. I don't have my fucking glasses, so I wear glasses now. Thank you very much.
And you have an office. You're so distinguished.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Let's see here. Stay with me for a minute. Here it is. So, Jason, I have killed 55 as
that's
Jason.
It?
55.
That's kind of weak. I think Gremlins killed more than that.
Well, possibly, but I did it by myself. 55, and that's considering Jason Goes to Hell, I only killed one person. So that brought the average way down. As Victor, 62.
Wow.
Yes.
I hope they're not counting me in that 62, because you did not kill me.
No, I only count the ones I physically kill as my character. Yes, you're right.
All right, good. But so speaking of Victor Crowley, and I did just kind of throw a little Gremlins in there. Zach, if you were to say who would win in a fight, would it be Stripe Gremlin or Victor Crowley?
I would bend Stripe over a fucking stump in the bayou.
This question was not for you.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Well, the thing, obviously, the thing with Gremlins is, you know, you can't just do a one-on-one thing because their whole thing is overwhelming you with sheer numbers.
That's
true. I think Victor Crowley versus 20 Gremlins would be pretty tough for Victor Crowley.
Ooh, oh. I think he's right. I think some fan out there has to make the animatic of you getting your ass kicked by a bunch of
pretty funny
angry Mogwai.
Well, I know you didn't want to reveal it, Zach, but what? Tell what happened to you in Hatchet.
Oh, in Hatchet 3?
Well,
there's a hole in that there's he's got like a Victor has something like a sandblaster or something like that. He's trying to cut his way into the ambulance boat. And so he cuts a hole in and then he kind of withdraws the sander and that has carved its way through, and I go and I stick my head through the hole and Kane rips it off and blood squirts everywhere. Luckily we did that in one take and several long showers afterwards.
Together.
I love that it makes Kane so happy to hear this. Like he's like a giddy little kid when you talk about him killing people. It's like
I know. It's and Zach, I know there was a scene that I did at that time on the boat where I didn't even have the Victor head on. Was that yours or something else? Because
I'm pretty sure that might have been I think that was mine because I don't ever actually, in that sequence, I don't ever see you. You right. see me stick my head in and then it just comes right. back into the boat headless.
Right. Ugh. So I remember there being pictures from the set from that night and I have everything on except the head and it looks really weird. And I think they've been published somewhere. I've seen them.
So so the one you were in, Zach, is the one that the BJ directed, right? Or Adam Green?
No, that's right. That's the one that BJ McDonald directed because Adam at the time, he was on the set. He was always, you know, less than 50 feet away if we needed him. But he was in his trailer and he was rapidly writing, like, I think it was the second season of Holliston. So he was like trying to do two things at once.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So, I mean, clearly we're all big Hatchet franchise fans and Gremlins fans. I particularly was a big Waxwork fan growing up. Big fan. Like I thought that was just the coolest setup for a horror film and still do. And for any of you out there that haven't seen it, Zach plays like, I felt like you were so different from your Gremlins character. Was that like a choice? Were you like, I want to go after something that's very different and like a little edgier? Or was it just like, oh shit, this cool horror movie came to me?
No, actually, you know, this is probably my favorite Waxwork story because most people don't know this. But it's 1987 and I'm looking for, you know, I've just moved out to Los Angeles, where I'm actually about to move out to Los Angeles. And I'm looking for something to do and trying to, you know, sift through some of the offers. And a lot of what I was getting offered at the time was pretty bad. And then I got sent Waxwork and I read it. And I thought that the concept was kind of interesting, but I thought that the dialogue was really, really bad. Like really almost undoable. And what happened was I was like, is this guy British? Because he has these kids living in LA and they're like, hi mate, do you fancy getting in my lorry? And I'm like, what the, nobody in LA talks like this. It's like, this is clearly a British guy who doesn't know how to write American dialogue. So I had I didn't have to audition for it, but I did have to meet with the director. And I said to my manager at the time, I said, Chuck, I'm not going to take this movie. I mean, the dialogue is really painful. And he goes, just take the meeting, meet the guy. You know, if you want to decline, I'll decline for you. If you want to decline in person, you can do whatever. But, you might as well meet this guy because he got a little heat on him. So I said, okay. So I met Tony Hickox at Hugo's on Santa Monica and King's Road. Mm-hmm. And we sat down. And if you don't know Tony, he's a rather gregarious, charming guy. And he's also quite convincing and quite aggressive. So he said, so what do you think about the script? And, you know, I'm not going to come out and just, I've made that mistake before where I've told him honestly what I think. So I was like, well, you know, it's good. And it's really interesting. And the wax displays thing. Oh, I like it. It's great. And whatever. And he's like, I sense some hesitation there. Is there a problem? And eventually he wore me down and I'm like, so look, here's the thing. Cause you know, he's like, are you all right? He's got an English accent. Although it's a bit more posh than I just did it then. And I go, okay, so here's the thing. I'm going to be honest with you. I thought to myself, I might as well be honest since I'm turning it down. I said, here's the thing. The dialogue sounds like it's written by you, a guy from England. It doesn't sound like people from LA. And that's kind of a big problem. He goes, totally agree. You can say whatever you want. He says, you can make, what I mean by that is you can make it your own. So if you want to say, hey guys, let's, you know, get over here and get in the truck, you can say that. You don't have to say Laurie or whatever it is. I don't know Americans, that you guys can fix that. So don't worry about that. You'll say whatever you want. I won't have you say something you don't want to say. And I go, oh, okay. And he goes, what's your next concern? And I go, well, I also have a problem with this. He's like, fixed. We've got that. That's fixed. What's your next problem? And I went down 3 or 4 more problems and he said, they're all fixed. What else? And I'm like, I don't have any more problems. He's like, welcome aboard. And I'm like, what? He's like, welcome aboard. It's great. And I was like, you know, I'm 23 at the time. I'm like, okay, yeah. And so I got on the phone with my manager and he goes, so did you let him down easy? And I go, actually, I'm doing the movie. He's like, what? You're doing the movie? I thought you were going to turn it down. I said, the guy was so convincing and every problem I had, he had a solution for it. He got me so excited about it. He showed me sketches and drawings. It's like, you know, it's like I was someone who lived in the North Pole. He just sold me snow.
Did he really address all of those concerns you had on the list? Were they all truly taken care of?
Yeah. I mean, eventually, pretty much. Yeah. And actually, you know, I had an incredibly fun time on the shoot. I loved everybody that he cast. I thought he had interesting casting choices and there were some really fun people there. And I thought he was a great guy. And we went on to be super great friends for a long time until we moved to separate cities and stuff like that. But my God, all through the 90s, we just partied our brains out in LA and had a fabulous, fabulous time. But that's the funny thing about Waxwork was I only took the meeting as a courtesy. I had no intention of ever doing that or Waxwork too, and ended up doing both of them.
That's crazy.
I love this story.
Zach, did Tony direct two also?
He did. He wrote two in like some feverish 72-hour thing where he's, you know, kind of like Stallone and Rocky. Not that they're the same movie, of course, but he just sat down and was sort of like blah, and just spilled it all out.
Because I worked on that one.
What'd you say?
I worked on two.
Oh, were you a stunt on that?
Yeah, I don't even remember what I did, but the subtitle was Lost in Time, I think, or something.
Yeah. And you know, the thing about Waxwork too is, I mean, if you think the first one's kind of nuts, the second one is batshit crazy. I mean, you know, I remember one time people came up to me and said, what's Waxwork 2 about? I'm like, your guess is as good as mine and I'm the lead, you know, it's like, it's open to interpretation. But the thing that was so great about Waxwork 2, of course, is that I got to work with David Carradine.
Yeah.
You know, Maxwell Caulfield.
Oh, I was in love with him. Grease Tim.
Everyone was in love with him in Grease Tim.
Bruce Campbell.
I forgot Bruce Campbell was in that.
Yeah, Bruce Campbell, Sophie Ward, Marina Sirtis. I mean, wow. You know, kind of had a lot of really good people in there. And it was just a tremendous amount of fun. It was actually much harder work because I was my part was larger, which is hard to believe because it's pretty big in Waxwork, but Waxwork 2, my part was larger and it was less of an ensemble. And I was that we had two units going, an A and a B unit, and I was going from A to B to A to B. And we did, you know, 5 weeks of 6 days with just the Sunday off, and we were shooting in a terrible nasty section of Los Angeles at the time called Vernon, which is basically like all slaughterhouses and stuff like that. Ooh. And it was a very tough shoot, but I think Waxer 2 is absolutely hilarious.
Were you, I mean, cause clearly like we've all seen and been with you at conventions and stuff now and a lot of big horror shows, like, so certainly you've embraced the horror side of it, but were you a fan before you did any of these movies or just an actor?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I really think to a certain extent that a lot of times, I know this is true for me, so I can't really talk about, you know, speak for other actors, but I think we kind of gravitate towards stuff that we want to do. So if there are genres that you don't really like at all, you probably don't audition with the same amount of enthusiasm and intensity, even if you try and do it as professionally as possible, because your heart may just not be in it. You know, and I think I always loved, I mean, I really just feel like I always loved horror movies, especially when I was, you know, a kid. I loved being scared by them. I can remember seeing Steve McQueen in The Blob when I was like 7 years old. And that movie, you remember, most things scare you when you're seven, but that thing really frightened me with the old man and the stick, and he pokes it in the blob, and then the blob goes up his hand and it's stuck on his arm, and they bring him to the hospital and he's crying because he's got this thing in his arm and it's eating his arm. Awful. When you're 7 years old, you're like this.
That's awful now. Like, could you imagine right now in a pandemic if you had a blob on your arm and you get to the hospital and they're like, sorry, we ain't treating that.
You're like, so gross. Zach, what's your favorite experience on set, like in a, making a horror film? What's been your like most exciting moment?
Wow.
I got the hard hitting Quino.
Yeah, Felissa brings it all to a halt.
When you've done, the problem is when you've done a bunch of horror movies, you have to cycle through a bunch of them and see, you know, if you've only done two or three, you can pick out one, but.
Well, how about the hardest or worst?
Well, really, I mean, quite honestly, and I've spoken about this many times and Kane kind of hinted at it, the 6 days in a row that we did in the Louisiana Bayou in June, in terms of being a miserable shoot, I mean, it was weird because it was a great shoot because the people were so great. I had an absolute blast. And when I look back at it, I smile and I feel very warmly about everybody. And we had some absolutely hilarious times on it. But my God, you know, people really don't believe some of the stories I tell. But, you know, I had after day one, I didn't realize that mosquitoes would bite the palms of your hands. So I covered everything up with the palms of my hands. And when I came home from the first night of shooting, I had 17 bites on one palm and 14 bites on the other.
Oh, man. I'm sorry.
And my hands were just itching and eating alive. And then, you know, there was a sequence where Kane drags me across the ground and I got like these things called chiggers that are kind of burrow under your flesh. And so you have to put nail polish on them to kill them. So they
and then they like crawl out, right? Like you were able to take them out.
I can't even go back and tell. All I can tell you is that like by the fifth or sixth day, my hands were just nothing but bumps.
I'm sorry. Sean Whalen was on that shoot. I remember him telling me, he was like, he's saying the same thing you're saying. It was the best shoot, the camaraderie, the love, the fun, the people, but it was horrible, the landscape, the environment, the elements.
Yeah, could you imagine if we did Victor Crowley in Louisiana, like being on that plane in the heat? Like, thankfully we were just in, you know, Santa Clarita, California, where, you know, it was pretty tempting. Like times we were just like, oh, it's a little cold.
Well, but thanks to Hatchet 3, we weren't there.
This is true. So we owe everything to Zach.
I don't know about that, but I was very thankful. I mean, when we did the ambulance boat sequence in Adam's backyard, I mean, it was heavy, you know, in comparison.
Sure.
You're in Southern California. There are no bugs of any kind, and it's perfect weather all the time. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it was really brutal. And it took several days for my hands just to recover. And by the way, I knew the next day, I was like, oh, I'm going to take care of it. And there was no insect repellent that would work, none. And then they just would start biting you. And the mosquitoes were, you know, Kane will tell you, they were this big. They were like, at times I thought they were birds.
Zach's character was like this the whole film.
That got terrible. Well, like, let's talk about something better. I actually really want to know what all of you guys did, and I'm sure it's very similar. New Year's Eve. Was there any excitement in any of the households? Did you guys do anything that was sort of different than every other day this past year?
Get drunk, you know, watch a show. Yeah.
What'd you watch?
I was watching Carson Daly's Countdown. I don't know. It was just me, my husband, and my son. My two girls went to their friends' houses, and we just had a lot of laughs. We wore hats. We had the little, you know, noisemakers.
And like a trumpet.
I know. All of a sudden, I'm like, we had these trombones that were unbelievable. No, we cooked, we baked, because Tiffany loves baking, and we just had fun. And I think that's what we learned from quarantine, coming together, really embracing the family and loving each other and being home. I liked the fact that I didn't have to say, okay, where am I going? It's New Year's Eve. I have to get drunk and find a party. I do feel obligated. I don't know how you all feel every year. Like, where am I going? It's New Year's.
No, I've never felt obligated to go somewhere, because I always felt like it's the more expensive night where everything takes longer. You get shittier food. You get more of the drunk idiots that are out. Probably me running into Felissa at the party going,
I'm very immature. Jesus. I admit it. I just, you know, that's me being juvenile. I like to go.
But in fairness, I think I'm like the old lady, because Sean will tell you, I have taken him to some very terrible actual old people New Year's Eves. Like we ended up at one where, I shit you not, it was like an old woman and like a 3-piece band behind her, and she was singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Stop it.
He was like, why did we come to this? I'm like, I don't know. It said big band.
It said bingo, not big band. Bingo.
We've ended up at a lot of terrible things like that. So being home was actually a step up. Like, at least we had good music and... We were the youngest people.
We, you know, as you already know, I'm up in Park City at the house, and my wife's sister, they just closed on their house in the same neighborhood on December 11th. And they did a real big house, and we were all there for New Year's. And, you know, both my sons are here. Two of the three of her sons were there. And I've talked about this before, but all five of the boys, my two sons, my three nephews, were all born within 5 years. So they're all very close to each other. We had a great time, and we arrived at the house to celebrate New Year's at, like, you know, 6 o'clock or something. And there was still somebody working on the house, trying to finish up the fireplace. So the poor guy's working on New Year's Eve, but it's because he was late, so I can't feel too sorry for him. But we had a great time, and I said, did you get your alcohol delivered? He said, yeah, there's some over there. My brother-in-law says, there's some over there. And I go in the cabinet, and there's 7 bottles of Angel's Envy, multiple bottles of different vodkas and other bourbons and rye whiskey. And I'm like, okay, I guess we're set. And so we had a great time. We just, we played Quiplash, if you know that game, you do it on TV, it's a lot of fun. And we just sat around and drank and watched one of my nephews get shit-faced. So that was fun.
That's there you go.
Fun. I'm coming there next year.
Yeah, we're all coming.
How'd you make out on New Year's Eve?
How did I?
Yeah.
Well, I actually, January 1st this year was 4 years since I've had a drink. Not that I'm an AA person or anything, But I just, at a certain point, I kind of just was like, you know, this really isn't being fun for me anymore as I get into my 50s. And so I thought, you know what, I'm just going to take a month off and see how I felt. And I took a month off and I felt pretty good. So I thought I would do it for another month and then another month after that. And it's been basically four years, you know, even maybe even a little bit longer, because I did a New Year's in 2016 going into 17. But other than that, really haven't been drinking in about 4.5, 5 years. And, you know, I'm not a preachy person, so I'm not going to say, oh, do this, don't do that. But all I can say is that for me, it was a life-changing experience, and it has made my life immeasurably better just staying away from booze in particular, especially hard liquor, because I come from an Irish family, and we were all, well, with the exception of my dad, but a lot of us, there was my mom's wing, shall we say, of the side of the family, very, very heavy Irish drinkers. And so basically I sat on my couch with my cats and watched a friend of mine. She does a stream actually on Twitch, which is really fun. And so I watched that. I watched the ball come down. And what's amazing is if you don't drink, New Year's Eve becomes a completely different holiday. It's a holiday that's like 20 minutes long. You turn the ball on 10 minutes beforehand, you watch it, you get up, you hug the people that you're with, and this and that. And by 12:15, you're done, you know?
Oh, that was the same for drinking people too. It was like 12:05. I was like, all right, let's pack it up. We're going to bed. Like, we really spent it well, in our house, and I cook steaks, and we watched part of the ball dropping, put on some music, and then we watched, our son wanted to watch these guys on YouTube. And if no one's ever seen them, I really encourage you to, because you will feel like a real loser in your life. There are these two guys that live in like the brush, and they make houses out of like sticks and mud, and you really will turn around and go like, how can I not even paint this wall? But these dudes just built like a place with a water slide and four stories out of some twigs. Like, and it's unbelievable.
What channel is this?
It's on YouTube. Like, literally just Google, like YouTube search brush men build. And
okay. I will, because it does generate a certain like enthusiasm for things that maybe you know, neglect. I mean, I don't know about building homes and whatnot, but I think it inspires you. I love finding channels.
It was really cool. So that's what we did, Zach. It was very similar. And then at 12:05, it was like, all right, let's go to sleep, because Max is still going to be up at, you know, 5 a.m. Anybody do any New Year's resolutions? Like, I don't, because I then will feel bad if I stop doing them. But do you guys?
I started doing them and I love them. 2 years ago, I started with something that it was just, for me, very peaceful, living presently, living in the moment, really being here, like really looking at Zach, really listening to everyone, Kane and Tiffany. Like, that to me was so brilliant, and it's followed through, and it's been the most amazing part of my existence on this journey, is just being here. And especially then you hit something like COVID and it really kind of resonates, like, wow, we just have to kind of settle and regroup and appreciate in gratitude, as I'm constantly preaching, always living in gratitude. But this year I kind of took it to another level, and it was just like, really, my meditation is super important, because I think then that becomes an inward, like just mind, body, and soul, and feeling very peaceful. So it's just kind of like this evolution of wanting to feel happy and joyful and living on that vibration all the time.
That's cool. Zach?
One of my resolutions is that I write a lot, and you know, whether it's screenplays or short stories or stuff like that. And this last year, I really kind of, just with COVID and everything, I guess you could say it was lazy, but it was also kind of like, I felt like I had been going for years and years and years and years and years without a break. And I kind of felt like, you know what, I can kind of take 6 to 8 months off and just, you know, not really do much of anything except whatever I feel like doing. So I, you know, for the last eight or 10 months, I've essentially just been going to the gym nonstop, getting lots of sleep, reading, watching stuff, you know, that kind of a thing, like just taking a break. Before that, I'd, you know, I'd been acting for years in New York, and then I moved out to LA, and then I moved back to New York. I was teaching at NYU for 10 years, and I just felt like 35, 36, 37 years in a row of just constant, endless, you know, moving and thising and thatting and struggling and that, and then moving down here to Atlanta where I live now. And I finally was like, you know what? I'm in a position where I actually, now that I don't live in either New York or Los Angeles, and actually can, you know, do something like save money and not not be just like have the financial water level at my nose all the time where I can barely breathe. Mm-hmm. So I just was like, you know what? Screw it. I'm just going to take this year off and most of the year off and just chill and relax. So now it's kind of like my New Year's resolution is like, okay, you did that, dude. It's time to get back to work.
I love that. I think that's sort of the same thing. It's like just taking life in a way that's really more peaceful. And NYU, I'm an NYU graduate, Zach. Yay. I went to Strasbourg for 4 years.
Oh.
Yeah. I wonder if I'm sure we know a lot of the same people.
Cross paths. Like, Zach, did you audition for Sleepaway Camp?
Oh, God.
Could have.
Okay.
Could have. Same. So,
how about you? Now, NYU was the greatest time of my life, so I probably talk about it a lot, but those were the greatest 4 years of I was there, you know, 87 to 91, and it was just brilliant.
Everyone I know that went to NYU or had any affiliation with NYU felt the same way, I feel like. Or maybe it's just New York in general, like, that people have a affection for, except for Kane. Kane hates all of us. But what's your resolution, Mr. Hodder?
I don't do resolutions because I don't know. I just don't feel that it's necessary. But, and, you know, I was deciding whether to mention this or not, because I know the reaction that's going to get from you, in particular, Shepis. Yes. But I am actively going to try my best. Not a resolution or anything, but to not, oh man, it's going to sound so fucking stupid.
I want to hear it. Come on.
I'm going to try my hardest this year not to threaten someone's life. See, there's Shepis right there. Laughing her ass off.
I think that's an excellent. Like, no, I love that resolution, Kane. And I think that's a really wonderful, you know.
Let my temper go. In certain situations, I think I'm right, and sometimes I am justified, but I'll threaten someone's life. And the problem with doing that,
it's bad. That's the problem.
The problem with doing it is you're always going to run into someone who's more unbalanced than you one day. Most often when I get really fucking mad and threaten somebody, they back down. But I'm going to run into that person that's not going to, then it'll escalate and somebody will get killed. So I'd rather not die that way. and, you know, so I'm going to really try to control my temper. No more, you know, I've showed you pictures of my garage cabinets with all the knuckle marks in it from punching it and stuff. I'm just going to try to not be such a fucking asshole with my temper,
and the world rejoices.
No, I think that's actually a great,
open up and smile.
I mean,
down.
I just think it's a great choice, Kane. I think it's a really healthy choice for your own. You know, thank you for sharing. First of all, I really appreciate it, and I think
me
it's
too.
Really once in a while, kind of look at self and regroup and decide what works and what doesn't. I mean, I rarely get angry, but when I do, it's kind of like it's bad. And I kind of started thinking the same thing. I'm producing a film right now and I see my temper at times gets like, so I have to get less agitated and kind of, you know, change the wheel. So I appreciate that.
And I was at conventions, I have come across, you know, sporadically, not often at all, but where because of the characters I play, someone will try to test my toughness or whatever you want to call it. But, oh, you think you're a badass because you play Jason and Victor Crowley. What makes you think you're a fucking, you know, and then So I'm going to try to just walk away from those situations too.
I think what we need to do is have Felissa produce a movie where you play like a Care Bear kind of character, like somebody that just exudes love and caring and hearts and rainbows and stuff. So then you could just be like, oh no, I'm not just that, I'm this, you know? And that's how you'll diffuse it.
I can be very kind and
loving. Well, a knife corp,
you punch right in the face.
Remember the film Knife Corp, when did we film that, 1 year ago? Or
he wasn't nice in that. He still killed people.
But he was a genuine, like, there were moments in that where he really had to reflect, and we saw a lot
of parents. No, he needs to play someone nice and charming, like Billy in Gremlins. that's what we need for Kane. Not anyone that kills people.
Well, I played myself in that Fanboy 13 movie. And I'm anxious for that to come out because I did a really emotional scene. I'll break your fucking heart, Sheppis.
I can't wait. Yeah, what, Zach?
I was going to say that Kane is kind of like the Bumble in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. He's like this big thing, and you think he's all scary and stuff like that. And then at the end, it turns out that he's a softie, and his little dentist friend goes, looky what he can do. Bumble,
we're going to call you from now on, our sweet Bumble.
Oh.
Bumble Hotter.
That's nice. That's
better than longer sexy motherfucker.
Yeah, no longer sexy mother Bumble.
Actually, one of the other things that I was going to say too, just to dovetail back a little bit, is most people probably don't think that I have a temper because I always play basically nice guys and stuff like that. But in real life, I had a really rather volatile temper. Even if I didn't end up, you know, coming to blows with people, I would mouth off and get in fights. And in my relationships, I'd raise my voice a lot, stuff like that. And I really did find that once I stopped drinking, my temper went down and my irritability went down by about 85%.
Wow.
So I do kind of wonder how much of people's, or at least male tempers, are alcohol related.
Well, let me ask you a question. Was it when you were drinking that you would get, you know, kind of more aggressive or volatile, or was it when you were sober and then you would take the drink? Like, how did that, how did you manage that?
It was one of two things. I would, you know, I found that alcohol was like a magnifying glass. So if I felt great, then when I was drunk, I was super great. And if I was feeling kind of moody and bitter or upset about something, and then I drank, that got magnified too. Or the second one was if I was like in a great mood and got drunk, and the next morning I woke up and I was hungover, I was super irritable, as most people are, and prone to exploding. So because I was repressing a lot of stuff down, and finally I was so irritable I just used it as an excuse to snap out. So I just, it's much better for me as a person just not to do that.
I wonder though, like, I mean, you were, I mean, in a huge movie at a fairly young age. I mean, not, you know, 13, you know, like some, but you know, did growing up famous in the 80s, you know, that lifestyle's outrageous. I mean, and not many people come out of it the way you have. Do you think any of that kind of contributed to it? Like, well, I've done my partying. I can stop now.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, without going into details, if I hadn't, you know, if you look at what I've done and say that I haven't partied, then I don't know who has partied, because basically from 1985 until 2002-03, I was just on a one long nonstop, you know, club hopping bender and trying to have an acting career at the same time. And a lot of times it didn't quite work. You know, my partying got in the way of my acting, or my acting got in the way of my partying. And so, like, you know, no one's ever going to say I got cheated. I mean, I was in New York in the 80s at the Limelight, Xenon, Studio 54 and all of that stuff. So it was wild.
Speaking of Limelight, did you guys just read that Michael Alec died? Remember?
I did.
Yeah, that was really strange. So I did, we talked about this on our show, but you don't know, Zach. I did a movie called Shampoo Horns, which was not a horror film, but it was a weird sort of mockumentary about the club life in Manhattan at the time. And it starred a lot of those guys like Michael Alec as himself and Freeze and, you know, Angel Rodriguez, who was murdered by them. But at the time, like, no one knew that these guys were killing people. They were just famous party kids. And it was produced by Pedro Almodovar. And so it had a lot of like weird kind of indie press around it. But I remember at the time I was really young, I was like 17 years old, and looking around at these kind of club kids, and they weren't famous people, but they were, it was just like being with a celebrity when you walked into those Manhattan clubs at the time. So I could only imagine being an actual celebrity, the treatment that you got going into those places.
And you couldn't get in the velvet ropes, you know, Nels. You,
oh yeah, Nels was great.
What is it, MK's? Was it MK's? Is that?
MK, yeah.
MK, I remember like, you wished you would just stand. Like I'd be in my Betsy Johnson dress, like pick me. I didn't, you know, too bad. I didn't know Zach. He was probably like ushered in. Were you even in the front? You probably got ushered in like through.
Yeah. Like how was that kind of celebrity at that age after Gremlins came out?
Well, I actually stumbled onto it on my 21st birthday. I was dating this girl at the time, and she and her roommate took me out for my birthday dinner. And afterwards they were like, why don't we go down to the Limelight? And I was like, what is that? They're like, oh, it's the hot club. And I was like, I don't know. I wasn't really clubbing at the time. But these girls were smart because they knew that that week I was actually on the cover of People magazine with Molly Ringwald for the surviving teenage suicide movie that I did. So I went down there, and as soon as I got to the front, the doorman, who actually, believe it or not, was Chaz Palminteri. He was doorman at Limelight before he was famous.
Wow.
So Chaz sees me and he grabs me and he takes me and the two girls. Luckily, the two girls were attractive and well-dressed as well. And we go straight up to the VIP room. And when I got up to the VIP room, you know, I mean, all I can say is this. Everyone who worked there essentially was gay. And I was a reasonably attractive 21-year-old male. And so I basically was given a gold Limelight card, that a VIP card that allowed me to come and go anywhere I want, any entrance, you know, no pun intended, any entrance to the back of the place or the front of the place, whatever. So I had carte blanche at Limelight for the next 2 years. I could bring anybody I want, come at any time, go to any room, go up into Peter Gation's office, who was the guy who ran it. I mean, I could do anything I wanted to. So basically on my 21st birthday, they gave me the keys to the kingdom. And I'll tell you something, I took them.
That's crazy. Wow. Was there ever a moment where you had to give it back? Like your card's been revoked?
The card, you know, I had the card until like 2005. And then when I moved from one place to the other, I lost it, but I had it for years, long after the club shut down. But the funny thing is that once I started going to Limelight, I became friends with all the super, I was pretty good at figuring out like, okay, who has the craziest level of access, and then would kind of befriend them. And one of the guys who I was very good friends with was a guy who just passed away a couple of years ago named Steven Sabin. And he was the nightlife columnist for Details Magazine, when Details Magazine was not a men's magazine. It was like a downtown New York magazine. And he literally had carte blanche, not just at the Limelight, but everywhere. So he and I and my other friend, Mitchell Baum, unfortunately, who's also passed away. I mean, you know, the club lifespan is not particularly very long. And the three of us would go around, and we, you know, literally from February 1985 to January 1987. So basically 2 years, I went to every single great party and club that you could have gone to in Manhattan in the middle of the 80s, including the opening of the Palladium, where I sat next to like Basquiat and Andy Warhol and Haring and Steve Rubell from Studio 50. I mean, everybody that you see documentaries about, I was on the couch with. It was crazy.
Wow.
That's
crazy, because you really do look and portray, and you actually still look so young that it doesn't seem like you lived that life. Like usually people that live that life are kind of gray and like chain smoking. No, I mean, gray in the face.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you look so young. It's incredible. And that lifestyle it's hard. It's a lot.
Why don't you write a book about it, Zach? Just about time of your life.
I've started to.
Okay, good.
No, that but he said he quit doing it. You need to go back to writing.
That's why I make the resolution, because I've told so many people about it. They're like, dude, you've got to write that thing. It's unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
Honestly, you have to, because like the three of us generally don't let our guests speak on our show because we talk and we're like,
it's compelling. Yeah.
Tell us more.
Yeah. These are great stories and important.
I had a last like kind of question before we wrap it up. I read somewhere that you did like to do some of your own stunts. And since we have a resident stunt guy here, I wanted to know a little bit more about that, because I know Felissa and I used to do a lot of our own. I mean, she still does. I'm kind of a baby, but is that something
you... I'm just a drunk idiot. I'm like, yeah, you can throw me on the table and shoot me.
But that's just Friday night.
That was just yesterday. Yeah, exactly.
Is that true?
Well, before I was an actor, I was very young, so it wasn't a realistic thing, but there was part of me that wanted to be a stuntman. I thought that stuntmen were incredibly cool. And in the late 70s, there were movies like Hooper with Burt Reynolds, and also there's a movie called The Stuntman about stuntmen with Steve Railsback, Peter O'Toole. Mm-hmm. And so when I was young, really young, like 12, 13 years old, I would have like fake fist fights with my friends where I'd take punches and we'd make like silly kind of with early video cameras. We'd see the movie, The Warriors, and we'd make our own fist fights and fall back into the lens, like this, and these kind of fun things and stuff like that. And so when I started being an actor, basically from my first movie, Nothing Lasts Forever, I did all my fight scenes and took a couple of punches and fell into like a small pool of water. And all through the 80s through Waxwork too, did all my own stunts in Waxwork too, all the fight scenes and the choreography and stuff like that.
Wait, what did Kane do then? Kane?
I don't even remember. I don't remember what I did. It wasn't a very long job for me, so.
Here's the thing. I had, and Kane will, I'd be stunned if Kane didn't know this guy, but there was a guy named Eddie Braun, and he was my stunt double for a lot of stuff when the producers would just say, we can't let you do that. It's too dangerous. Jumping off a pier in Santa Monica for this movie Ice, I wanted to do, they wouldn't let me do that. That was the Santa Monica pier. And, there were certain things they wouldn't let me do. And Eddie Braun doubled me a number of times, and Charlie Sheen, because Sheen and I kind of were basically the same physical build and dark complected hair-wise and whatever. He was a good match for both of us. So I did have, a kind of a go-to stunt double guy that they would use. But I would try and do almost all my fight scenes myself. And then eventually I just got older and I started getting less dynamic action-y type stuff, because that just tends to go towards, younger guys.
Right. Yeah. I know Eddie Braun very well. We worked together for years early in his career. I think he was with us in South Africa on American Ninja 2. And I think we did one in New Orleans too, but yeah, he's been around for a long time. Very well respected stuntman.
Sure.
But, and as a stunt coordinator, one of the things that you don't really necessarily like to hear is an actor coming to you and saying, "Hey, I'd like to do some of my stunts." It kind of makes you roll your eyes, because typically, not always, but typically it's not going to look as good if an actor does it. The good thing is you don't have to hide someone's face. You can show that the actor is doing that stunt, like a fight scene or something. a stunt double will take a punch and, you know, do that so you don't see that it's him. But when an actor does a fight, I like it because then you can just go all out and show anything. But, you know, also you as stunt coordinator are now taking on the responsibility of the safety of the actor. So sure. It's not just about thinking about someone's ability. You're thinking, boy, if this actor gets hurt, and I'm supposed to be supervising, that's not good.
Well, it's scary for anyone. Like when I did a fight scene on 12 Monkeys and I was doing all of the coordination with the stunt woman and it was like, this is great. And at the last minute, the lead actress of the show was like, oh no, I'll do the fight scene with Tiffany. And I was terrified because I'm like, what if I accidentally hit the stunt woman, it sucks. But I'm not gonna fuck up production. I'm not gonna delay anything.
That person, she takes.
If it. I accidentally hit the lead actress on the show in the face, so I ended up being overly cautious. And I told you guys before, like pulling every punch to where the stunt guy's like, what is she doing? But I was so scared of hurting her. Yeah. So I think it goes every which way. It's like the actor wants to do it to make it look good, but then you have other actors who are terrified to ruin this tape. It's just,
and it sometimes compromises the performance. I mean, if you have a stunt person and, you know, they're not acting the character, you know, so it depends on the actual scene and the stunt. That's why I like to do all my own, Kane, you know.
Well, not everyone can be as great as Felissa, and which is why we're going to let Felissa wrap up the New Year episode of Casualty Friday. First, like before I let her do that, I'm going to say thank you, Zach, for coming on to this. It was really like you told some crazy, great stories of movies that we have all seen and are fans of, but it's always great to hear stuff none of us ever knew. And you are clearly a class act and welcome back here anytime.
Perfect. Thanks so much.
And I have to say that, you know, Zach is one of the people I like running into at conventions because, you know, he's no bullshit about the guy. And I just enjoy whenever we're at a convention together. And I can't say that about all actors that do conventions, certainly.
He's actually just talking about us.
But because I'm trying to maintain my composure better this year, I'm not going to mention any of their names.
Wow, look at that turning of a leaf. I actually thought, Kane, though, I really did, and I was hoping that your resolution was going to be you weren't going to bully people about spelling or grammar.
I'm not bullying. See, Zach is a very intelligent man, just like Bill Moseley. I love talking to people like this because all we're doing is helping someone.
I think I'm just going to end meeting on Kane, but the three of us can keep going.
She controls it, man. And on that note, we just want to say thank you so much to our guest, Zach. We hope you have a brilliant and beautiful new beginning in this wonderful 2021. Tons of gratitude. Thank you so much for listening or watching Casualty Friday. We're here for you. Love our horror. Have a wonderful day.
Casualty Friday.
Happy New Year. Woo!